This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. One of the freshman members of Congress got his political education in the Black Panther Party. My guest is Bobby Rush, Democrat from Chicago. Rush co-founded the Illinois chapter of the Black Panther Party in 1969. The party supported revolution and armed itself to defend against racist attacks by police. Rush served as defense minister and also coordinated the party's Free Breakfast for Children program and free medical clinic. After the party broke up, he entered the Democratic Party. He was elected three times to Chicago City Council. In 1990, he was appointed deputy chair of the Illinois Democratic Party. Last summer, he was appointed director of the Democratic National Committee's drive to register people of color. The assassinations of President Kennedy and Martin Luther King were both turning points in his life. JFK's assassination inspired him to work for his country by joining the military. But he was up against racism in the military, and when King was assassinated, Rush went AWOL.
It was such an emotional and emotional turmoil that existed throughout the city and throughout the nation. And frankly, reporting back to the Army after Dr. King had been assassinated was the least thing on my mind. I felt a sense of total outrage. I didn't care. I didn't give a damn at that point in time about fulfilling, you know, my military obligations. And so I when I did finally return, they had court-martial proceedings initiated against me, but they decided that they wouldn't proceed with those, and because I was supposed to have been discharged anyway on the 20th of April, and Dr. King was killed on the 6th of April, on the 4th of April, rather. And so they gave me a discharge. I was discharged honorably from the military service.
What did you want to do with your life when you left the military?
Well, I knew that I was going to be committed to continue to fight in the civil rights movement and the movement for social change. And when I left the service, I immediately began to organize the Illinois chapter of the Black Panther Party, along with Fred Hampton and others. And so I knew that I was going to be involved in the civil rights movement.
What appealed to you about the Black Panthers and about their very militant stand?
I think that the militancy is what appealed to me. Dr. King, his posture of passive resistance really did not necessarily appeal to me as a young African American male who was raised in the inner cities and who, you know, was a part of the military and who was faced with the issues of police brutality and the issues that confront urban America, and the philosophy and the programs that was espoused more by Malcolm X appealed to me and to others of my generation.
Did nonviolent resistance seem too soft to you, or did you think that it wasn't going to be very effective in the North?
Well, I didn't think that it would be effective in the North, number one, and I thought that we were all searching for a sense of self-dignity, and passive resistance seemed to conflict with our sense of self-dignity and expressing our own self-dignity. Dr. King was a more spiritually directed, possibly, because he understood that it was a higher sense of, the way he explained it, it was a higher sense of expressing your dignity to be involved in passive resistance. But we couldn't accept that at that time. Police were systematically brutalizing and murdering black people and particularly young black males and getting away with it. And we didn't think that passive resistance was a way to deal with that. We felt as though we needed to be very, very militant in terms of our self-defense attitude and self-defense posture.
Fred Hampton was one of the Chicago Panthers, and he was killed in a police raid on his home. You were almost there, weren't you?
Right. Yeah, as a matter of fact, during that particular weekend, there was a retreat that we had in Chicago, and most of the leadership from across the state was here. And in fact, we had the leadership body was called the Central Committee, Central Staff, and the Central Staff had a meeting, scheduled a meeting, and actually had a meeting on the night of December the 3rd, and we were supposed to have had a meeting that was going to last throughout the night. But at around, I guess, 11:30, other Panthers began to come into the apartment where Fred lived and where we were having a meeting. And we found that there wasn't enough space for all of us to sleep overnight. And so we adjourned the meeting in order to meet the following morning. And that's why we weren't in that apartment. But the police, the informant, they did not have up-to-date information in order to pass on to the police forces who were planning the raid. But Fred Hampton did stay in that apartment that particular night.
How did you find out that he was murdered?
Well, I got a call at about 4 o'clock in the morning from a Panther member who lived about a block away. And she said that something was happening in at the chairman's house because the police had barricaded the entire block, had cordoned off the entire block. And I made some phone calls, and I had asked someone to come by and pick me up. My driver came by and picked me up, and we went to this person's apartment, and we still didn't know what happened. We got we turned on the local radios, all night radio station, news station here in Chicago, and I guess about 6:30 that morning, the news came over that Fred Hampton had been shot and had been killed, and that his body had been taken to the county morgue.
Then you went into hiding.
Not immediately. Once it became daylight, I went to the morgue to identify Fred's body, and the local media. We went to the apartment because at that time the police had retreated from the apartment, had left the apartment open, and so we had easy access to the apartment. And we went in and viewed the scene and determined that there had not been a shootout, that indeed Fred had been murdered. We call our legal team in and had some discussions with them and got information from surviving members of people who survived the raid, people who were in that apartment the night of and the morning of and survived the raid, and was beginning to put together various pieces of information to find out what had happened. And so that day was spent, for the most part, gathering that information. And we had a standing policy then that if, in fact, we expected a raid, or that indeed there was a raid, that the leadership of the chapter, particularly myself, that we would go underground. And indeed, that evening I did go underground. I was hid out on that particular evening, and at Father Clement's church. I can say that now. Statute of limitations has been over for many years, but Father Clement hid me out at Holy Angels Church.
Wasn't there a raid on your home while you were in hiding?
Yeah. The very next morning, the morning of December the 5th, the police department exercised what they considered was what they said it was a warrant to search my apartment for weapons. They came in, shot the door down, looking for me. And had I been in the home that evening, I would have been murdered also, me and my family. They indicated that that they found marijuana in my apartment, and upon further investigation, it was determined that the bag that they found these ingredients in, that bag contained bird seed as opposed to marijuana. So, but if I had been in that apartment, I would have been killed also.
So, how did you come out of hiding?
I turned myself into Operation Push, to Jesse Jackson Operation Push on that following Saturday. I left Father Clements and I moved around from place to place. I didn't stay in one location too long, so I was on the move, and we made some arrangements through my attorney, Kermit Coleman, who and the African American Patrolmen's Association, Renard Robinson and Howard Saffo, we made arrangements to turn myself into Operation Push on that Saturday, because I knew that if I turned myself into the police, or if they caught me on the street, then I would have been killed. And so we turned myself in front of literally thousands of people on one of the regular Saturday morning meetings of Operation Push. And Reverend Jackson turned me over to the black commander of the old Wentworth District, Commander Bob Harness, and I was taken to jail and released on my signature.
Did you have to serve any time? Were you tried? What happened?
No. The charges was dropped because they really had no charges.
Right, with these like marijuana charges?
They found no guns. And, no, right. Uh-huh. And the marijuana turned out to be bird seed, so they had no charges.
My guest is Bobby Rush, freshman congressman and former Black Panther. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Bobby Rush. He's a congressman from the state of Illinois. He's speaking to us from Chicago. How did you get from being a Panther to deciding and opposing the system, and knowing that there were a lot of people in the system who wanted to kill you? How did you go from that to deciding to run for office?
Well, in terms of the experience of the Panther Party, it was not Panther. Well, the Panther Party always rejected the notion that we were somehow operating outside of the system. I mean, you know, the Panther Party, they never did believe that we were in some type of state of Nirvana or state aloofness, that we were somehow suspended outside of the system. We knew that we were a part and parcel of this system, and that in order to really effect change, we'd have to try to transform the system from within. So we rejected the notion that we were outside of the system, and so therefore we supported candidates, and ultimately Panthers began to run for offices. You remember back in 1968, Eldridge Cleaver ran for Vice President of the United States on the Peace and Freedom Party ticket. In 1972, Bobby Seale was in a runoff election for the mayor of Oakland, California. Take the Breakfast for Children program for granted. I mean, that's a very, very basic program that right. is within the system, feeding hungry children before they go to school. And as a matter of fact, the system co-opted it. And this is, we knew that the system was going to co-opt it. That's why we started. So in terms of my own transformation, even though the Panther Party is no longer around, there's still basic attitudes that I embrace in terms of trying to be an effective force within the system. And when I decided to engage in politics, I knew that I could maintain a sense of commitment to changing conditions as it relates to poor people, as it relates to people who are suffering, as it relates to people who I serve, and that is not inconsistent. So nor is it some type of dramatic turnabout on my part to be involved in pursuing power. I mean, you know, we got to remember that I was a Black Power advocate in the 60s, and now I'm a part of the result of our attempts to achieve power for African Americans, and giving African Americans the power to control the destiny of their community.
When you started to run for office, did the Democrats welcome you, or were they cautious or suspicious because of your Panther background?
Well, when I first ran, I ran in a nonpartisan way. The established status quo conservative reactionary Democrats didn't want me. Okay, didn't want to have anything to do with me, so I you know, I certainly ran as a young insurgent.
Obviously, you did become accepted within the party, became the deputy chair of the Illinois Democratic Party in 1990, and I believe it was in 92 that you
became...
Well,
I won't say, in terms of being accepted, I accept that particular definition, but I became the deputy chairman not so much because of any acceptance by mainstream Democrats. I represented a district, which is the largest Democratic district in the nation,
right.
Certainly the largest Democratic district in the state of Illinois. The chairman, the individuals who were competing to become the chairman, they needed my vote. The person who I decided that I would support, I told him, I'll support you for chairman of the party, but in return for that, I want you to create a position, call it the deputy chairman, and I'm going to be the deputy chairman. So he agreed to that. So it wasn't an acceptance necessarily. They didn't reach out and say, "Okay, well, we're going to be good guys. We're going to accept." I mean, the reality is that if I didn't become the deputy chairman, then he would not have become the chairman.
I know one of the issues that has been important to you in your years in politics is crime in the housing projects of Chicago. Is there anything you feel that you could tell, say, young people in gangs now, young people in gangs who are selling drugs or using guns, about why they should stop? In your years of organizing, you know, having been a community organizer as a member of the Panthers, do you feel that you have any kind of special insights into?
Sure. I mean, the basic thing I would say is that there's no excuse for it. I mean, there is no excuse for it. There's no excuse for the drug proliferation, the handgun, proliferation. There's no excuse for the violence that's being conducted inside the African-American community. We can't blame any. There's nobody to blame except themselves. And the fact is that the African-American community as a community is becoming more and more intolerant of that type of behavior. Now, that's the premise that we have to begin with. Then, secondarily, we can begin to try to address some of the other concerns. We know that there are internal conditions, there are external conditions that keep the African American community in a position of struggle, in a position of chaos, a position where we are not able to effectively address the American dream and pursue that American dream. Some of those internal conditions is a sense of a lack of order inside of our community. A lot of it's perpetuated by some of the young folks who have no respect for any kind of authority, no respect for any kind of law, respect for any kind of institution or anything like that. What we've got to do is begin to say, look. I mean, your condition is no worse or no better than anybody else's condition. You know, I can address them from a point of view of total truth in saying that I was, you know, in my life, I was confronted with the same conditions, the same situation, all right, the same type of discrimination, the same bleak future. But, you know, instead of being a negative force on my community, I decided to be a positive force on my community, and I decided to engage myself in those activities that will push not only my community forward, but push me forward at the same time.
Because of gang-related murders that have happened in housing projects, there's been a series of police sweeps for arms and drugs in some of the housing projects, and I believe you've supported those sweeps. Do you have a lot more trust in the police now?
I think that the police institution as an institution is much more sensitive to the rights of all the citizens, much more sensitive to African Americans. We have more African Americans who are on police forces now. Some of them indeed are chiefs of police. There are officers within the police forces throughout the nation. And also the African-American community is much more political, much more the power of the African-American community in terms of local, state, and national politics is much stronger than it was in the past. And so, if a Daryl Yates, Gates rather, is the chief of a police force, urban police force, as he was in Los Angeles, and that police force acts contrary to the self-interest of the African American community or self-interest of the nation at large, then political pressure can be forced upon his superiors and the body politic to get him out of office, to fire him, to terminate his services. And that situation is similar in almost every city in this nation.
Tell us something of what your initiation into Congress has been like.
Well, it's been quite involved. I've been to at least four different orientations. I'm very, very honored to be in Congress. I look at the history of the institution. I look at people who, congressmen who preceded me, whose shoulders I stand on. I look at the potential and the possibility of what can be done in the Congress. And I'm somewhat astounded. I feel very, very good. I'm very, very excited about it. I'm somewhat weary of the different banquets and the balls and the various other kinds of pomp and circumstance that one goes through, I guess, every 4 years. But frankly, I'm ready to get to work now, and I'll be glad when the inauguration is finally over and the president sends this program over to the Congress, and so we can begin to work on the vital issues and the concerns of the American people.
Are you the first Panther in the U.S. Congress? First former Panther?
Yes, uh-huh.
It's interesting that, you know, you and John Lewis, the founder of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, mm-hmm. SNCC, are both in Congress now.
Yes, it is. Yes, John's and he's an excellent individual, and we have a lot of common history, and we have a lot of rapport. And John is one of my mentors.
Well, thank you very much for talking mm-hmm. with us.
Thank you.
Bobby Rush is a new Democratic member of the U.S. Congress. He spoke to us from Chicago. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.